I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. 16 more Americans died this weekend in a new round of attacks in Iraq. 14 soldiers and 2 civilian contractors. As the body count rises, many Americans are asking, how could things have gone so wrong so quickly? This was supposed to be a war of liberation, one that would be greeted by jubilant Iraqis showering troops with sweets and flowers, not bombs and rocket-propelled grenades. So Americans were told last spring, and so the Pentagon apparently believed. In his New York Times Magazine piece, Blueprint for a Mess, David Reif writes that early on, the civilian leaders of the Pentagon knew that post-war Iraq would be difficult, but they ignored those warnings, choosing instead to believe the rosy predictions of Iraqi exiles and their own ideological hopes and dreams. So here's the question. What did the U.S. get wrong in Iraq? And what can or should be done now? Are you committed to staying the course there, as the administration is urging? Or are you ready for an exit strategy? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And David Reif joins us now from Paris. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
You know, in some ways, the situation in Iraq does seem quite predictable. You put it in even stronger terms, flawed in its conception and ineptly carried out. So how did the Pentagon get it so wrong?
Well, I think they had a terminal case of wishful thinking. They believed really their own propaganda, their own desires. To some extent, they believed not what Iraqi exiles in general told them, but what the Iraqi exiles involved with or allied to Ahmed Chalabi's faction of the exile community, the Iraqi National Congress, told them. And the other thing is, I think they were so intent on persuading recalcitrant colleagues within the government, I'm obviously thinking of people in the State Department and the CIA, that everything would go smoothly, that they ended up completely distorting what any sensible observer should have known post-war Iraqi realities would be like. To me, it's simply a kind of terminal case of hubris and wishful thinking. It didn't have to be this way.
Well, now, you mentioned that the assumption that everything would go smoothly. Clearly, that hasn't happened. What were some of the other big assumptions that have not proven to be correct?
Well, it's not just a question of the general point about things going smoothly. It's a question of predictable events of the post-war in any war-torn country or country that's been under a brutal and vile dictatorship. And vile and brutal dictatorships didn't come any more brutal and vile than that of Saddam Hussein. For example, in all major post-conflict situations in the last 10 years, in the post-Cold War period, there have been major episodes of looting. The release of jailed convicts, which Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld now offers as a reason why the planners were surprised by the looting, was in fact public knowledge. It was on the front page of the New York Times, and I believe of every other major newspaper in the United States and in Western Europe. So in other words, things like the looting, things like the experience of Bosnia and Kosovo, which said when you take over a country, you've got to take it over. You can't simply win a war and then stand around for weeks at a time and let events get out of hand. These were lessons that already had been learned in Kosovo, in Bosnia, in the post-war evaluation of what had gone wrong in Somalia. But the Pentagon instead chose to believe that, in effect, Iraqis would greet Americans with flowers and candies and then, in effect, go back to work. It's the most extraordinary piece of myopia, I think, serious people have engaged in the United States in any historical time frame I'm familiar with.
Well, and even on that one tiny point about the sweets and flowers, I guess there are other Iraqis who say, sweets and flowers, you know, that's not how we welcome people. What are you talking about?
Well, I think the main point there is that it is possible to welcome your liberation from Saddam Hussein. And sitting here in Europe, I'm always painfully reminded that while Europeans may have opposed the war in Iraq, most Iraqis, both in my experience, I spent 2.5 months of the 6 post-war months in Iraq talking to Iraqis, including very anti-American Iraqis. I didn't meet many who opposed the war. But I do meet many who are capable of saying, we supported the American decision to overthrow Saddam Hussein. We do not, however, support either the occupation itself or, above all, the way in which the occupation has been carried out and the ways in which it's been botched. I don't see why it's so hard for Secretary Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz, Undersecretary Feith, Vice President Cheney, other people who are intelligent men, to get it into their heads that other intelligent men and women, i.e. the Iraqis, can have two thoughts in their heads at the same time.
Well, and in fact, as your reporting uncovered, I guess this was fairly well known as well, at the State Department, they had been studying this very intensively, 13 volumes of material on all aspects of what a post-war Iraq might look like.
In my view, there are two really catastrophic failures. The first is the failure to prepare the military for the post-war, and the after-action reports of military units are starting to come in which it becomes clear that the military was not given proper instructions from the civilian command authority about what to do once the fighting started, once major combat operations, to use President Bush's unfortunate phrase on that aircraft carrier, had concluded. The military is not an improvisational theater group. It doesn't do well when it has to make it up as it goes along. It needs to rehearse. The after-action report of the 3rd Infantry Division, which I quote in my Times piece, says the war itself was won on the practice fields of our division headquarters in Fort Stewart, Georgia. There was no practice for the post-war. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, of the other side of this ghastly coin, is that the Defense Department had at its disposal the best and brightest of the Iraqi exiles and the best and brightest of the State Department Arabists, who for one whole year had been planning, and I'm talking in the case of the Iraqi representative, a wide cross-section of Iraqi political opinion from non-Saddam, non-Ba'athist Iraqi political opinion, from monarchist to communist. I mean, the State Department was really ecumenical, if I may use another great religious traditions expression, in including all voices from these Iraqi opposition groups. They had worked their butts off, forgive me for putting it in a way I think still is acceptable on radio, trying to make a proper outline of what a post-war Iraq should look like, warning about the looting, inter alia. And all this work, all this brilliant work and collaboration, was thrown out the window by the Pentagon because of basically a food fight within the administration, or frankly, as William Kristol, the famous neoconservative writer and weekly news editor, has said, a civil war within the Bush administration. So basically anything that came from the State Department was anathema in the eyes of the Pentagon, and the Pentagon was running the show as far as both the Iraq war was concerned and post-war planning was concerned.
Well, David, I want to bring into the conversation now one of the people who was one of those voices, Faisal Istrabadi, was a member of that State Department's Future of Iraq Working Group. He's a senior fellow at the DePaul University School of Law in Chicago and has also been to Iraq twice since the war ended. So we want to welcome you, Faisal, and I want to ask what your input was. What were those discussions that you heard, and were you horrified when those ideas apparently were just put aside?
Well, when I was first contacted, and I had multiple involvement with the Future of Iraq project. First of all, I was on the advisory committee or the planning committee before the Future of Iraq project even got started. Then I served on more than one of the working groups. We had all, I think, assumed that we were consulting with the government of the United States about the problems it might confront in future Iraq and ways and sort of how to rebuild or what Iraq should look like, 10 years on or whatever. What became clear in retrospect, to me at least, maybe others knew it ahead of time, is we weren't actually consulting with the United States government. We were consulting with the State Department, and that's a very different thing. It was really, as a citizen of this country, it was eye-opening to me to see how the internecine fighting can take over. And really, deep six was in fact a pretty good idea. The premise of the Future of Iraq project, you see, was that we in Afghanistan were forced to act by September 11th and rather forced to act spontaneously. But in the case of Iraq, we have time to plan. Let's use that time I mean, it was, I think, an outstanding premise. Unfortunately, it wasn't carried through.
So what you're saying then is that because this was a State Department project, the rest of the government felt under no obligation to pay any attention to it?
That's more or less how it turned out.
What of the developments that you have seen since then concerns you most?
Well, the most important one is the absence of security. There are positive things happening in Iraq. That's absolutely true. And those who are saying that are correct. But the complete absence of real security in Baghdad is a potentially mortal wound. It is something that has to be got control of. There is one thing you have to remember. It's not the case that all Iraqis, or even a majority, or even a large minority of Iraqis, are engaging in these acts. If there were sort of mass resistance to the United States, you would have massive casualties, which we really don't. It is, however, the case that because of, I think, a lack of numbers, among other things, and a lack of preparedness, we allow the occasional suicide bomber, the occasional individual with a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, to constantly grab the headline.
Not so occasional anymore.
Well, I mean, look, we've had approximately 200 deaths, and I mourn them as a citizen. I pay tribute to their deaths. But honestly, we have taken over a country the size of France. Now, how many hundreds of people were dying per hour on D-Day? I mean, let's get some perspective. On the other hand, the main target of these attacks, the main victims have been Iraqis. Far more Iraqis have died than Americans since May the 1st as a consequence of these attacks. The problem is that what's happening is that perception becomes reality. And on the ground in Iraq, in Baghdad at least, which is extremely important to the rest of the country, what you have is an impression of things deteriorating over a six-month period now. And that is a reality with which we have failed, in my opinion, to come to grips.
Well, is it too late now? Is it still possible, particularly on the security aspects, to try to solve at least that piece of the puzzle?
It can't be too late. I mean, I'm somewhat reminded of Queen Victoria's comment about the Boer War: we are not interested in the possibilities of defeat, they do not exist. Well, of course, the possibilities of defeat do exist, and the British were defeated in the Boer War. But the stakes here are simply too high. This is an untenable situation. You can't allow, and I watched Ambassador Bremer's interview yesterday on CNN, you can't wait for another year to have a 40 or 50,000 man Iraqi civil defense force. I think it's imperative, and it's being discussed finally. I think it's imperative to reverse a decision that was made in the middle of May, that is, to disband the Iraqi army. I think it's imperative to recall the remnants of the Iraqi conscript army back into service to help provide security as a national emergency defense force.
All right. We'll be picking up on that point when we return after a quick break. Connection listeners, what did the U.S. get wrong in Iraq, and what can or should be done now? We'll continue our conversation, and we invite your phone calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And we're continuing our conversation this hour about what has gone wrong in post-war Iraq and whether some of those things could have been avoided. I'm joined now on the line from San Francisco by David Phillips. He was an architect of the State Department's Democratic Principles Working Group, also served on that group, and he's now Deputy Director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. So welcome to you, David.
Thank you.
I want to ask you to react to what you heard from Faisal and David Reif in our first segment about what happened. Why do you think it has played out the way it has?
Well, two important points. The Iraqis involved in the Future of Iraq project refused to endorse the notion of a provisional government in exile, which was backed by civilians in the Pentagon. presumably they wanted to establish the provisional government with Ahmed Chalabi as its head, and the moment of liberation to drop Chalabi and his Iraqi National Congress cohorts into Baghdad to run the country. As soon as it was clear that other Iraqis didn't endorse that idea lock, stock, and barrel, the zealots in the Pentagon went about undermining the Future of Iraq project. The second important point has to do with security. The Democratic Principles Working Group, which Iraqis themselves call the mother of all working groups, developed an elaborate procedure for de-bathification, for endorsing a truth and reconciliation process, for developing criteria and vetting officials. The idea was to eliminate those in the Iraqi armed forces who had committed atrocities, and instead of disbanding the 400,000-man Iraqi army, to make it a partner in security. The moment that the Coalition Provisional Authority banned the army, it instantly created 400,000 adversaries. And the reason why it banned the army is because it wanted to eliminate any alternate centers of gravity that might be a challenge to Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress. Really, the root of the problem was this conspiracy between civilians in the Pentagon and Ahmed Chalabi to take over the country and to refashion it in a way that would do America's, that would serve America's interests.
Well, and these 400,000 soldiers that you mentioned, not only adversaries, but adversaries with access to weapons and trained in how to use them.
And hostile, because they enjoyed a privileged position previously in Iraq. Now they're unemployed. They're not able to provide for their families. They deeply resent the way that they were treated, particularly because they stood down and didn't oppose the U.S. Armed Forces. They were promised special treatment. They didn't get it.
And so what might have been another way of dealing with them?
To remove the upper echelons, particularly those that had committed atrocities, and instead of giving them a pink slip, give them instructions as to how they would work under Coalition Provisional Authority Command as partners in security. They know the neighborhoods all over Iraq. They could have been invaluable assets instead of adversaries.
David Reif, what's your take on that? Was this a mistake, particularly with the Army?
Oh, I think it was a catastrophic mistake. I don't think it was the only mistake. It may well have been the motivation. I should quickly add that in the course of researching this story, 2.5 months on and off in Iraq, a huge amount of time in Washington, a huge amount of time on the phone, no one at a senior level of the Defense Department or of the CPA would talk to me except ex-officials. So, I mean, I can only speculate. Both Faisal and David were actually there, and I defer to them on these questions. I think this is the most colossal act of hubris on the part of an administration in my memory. I think it's not all... I agree entirely that Chalabi was part of the story. Indeed, one of the things that didn't make it into my New York Times Magazine piece was an interview with an official of the Iraqi National Congress who claimed that he had been told before the war he and his organization would be responsible for policing Baghdad, and that at the last minute, as he said, that the Free Iraqi Forces, the sort of militia group more or less loyal to Chalabi, disbanded by the American authorities, and he couldn't account for it, and went on claiming if they, the INC and the FIF, had been given their head in Baghdad, all would have been well. I think there is also a tremendous complacency in at least the Pentagon about what force can accomplish. I think that they could have looked no further than the Israeli situation to see that force may be necessary, but it's never sufficient. But then, of course, a lot of these neoconservative figures, I'm not including Donald Rumsfeld incidentally in this, I don't believe he is a neoconservative, but people like Wolfowitz and above all people like Richard Perle and Douglas Feith are people aligned with the sort of Ariel Sharon view of the world, which is a view that exalts force. What Iraq is proving, among other things, are both the potentials of military power and its limits, and that was a lesson I don't think had sunk in at the Pentagon, and I'm not so sure, alas, it's sunk in yet.
All right, let's see what some of our callers think. We're going to go first to Salem, Massachusetts, and hear from Jay. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I just want to say that this conversation is a little bit like looking back on a football game, and hindsight is 20/20. I was drastically opposed to this war because a number of us thought that the U.S. troops could be like fish in the barrel over there after the fact. We have a nationalistic, titanic philosophy at the head of our government that says that we're so big in the world that we can go push people around whatever way we want to do, and that they're going to like us for that. We are totally out of touch with the way the rest of the world sees us, the fact that they see us as totally self-interested. And having said that, I think we have to stay there, and I think the people that made this ludicrous decision have to stand and take responsibility for it so that our country can finally understand that we can't be pushing people around.
But why stay, Jake?
Well, because if we leave, we're going to ratify the world public opinion that we're basically self-interested, and if we lose more than six people in a war, we're going to turn tail and run, and that we don't give a crap about anybody else. And it's at the core of our integrity in the world as a future player.
All right. Appreciate the call, Jay.
May David? I answer one part of that? It is simply not the case that the Iraqi people oppose this war. It is the case. I spend a lot of my life, my private life and my professional life, in Western Europe. I'm well aware of the opinion in Western Europe about this war, which is overwhelmingly anti. But it isn't true that the Iraqi people oppose this war. Indeed, the people I've been talking to on the ground in Iraq are people, including many people who want the Americans out yesterday, still support the decision of the United States to overthrow Saddam. The other thing I'd like to say is that it's not a case of 20/20 hindsight or Monday morning quarterbacking. It's a case of examining the record. What both David Phillips and Faisal Istrabadi have said is that, in effect, an alternative view of what to do in post-war Iraq was offered to the Pentagon and rejected by the Pentagon. This is not after the fact. This was before the fact.
Well, Faisal, quickly,
sure,
and then I want to get some thoughts from Faisal as well, because you've been there a couple of times since the war. But David Phillips, go ahead.
It's important to keep in mind what the Pentagon was really driving at here. The strategy was to get rid of Saddam Hussein and then to use Iraq as a launching point for reshaping the entire Middle East. That would start with undermining the Ba'ath Party in Syria, going after the mullahs in Iran, creating a region that was non-threatening to Israel and benign to America's interests. There was a master plan that was driving the Pentagon, and it started with Iraq. It's because the post-war situation in Iraq isn't going well that we haven't moved on to take out other regimes that we deem unfriendly in the region.
Okay, Faisal, I'm sorry. I cut you off before I realized that's who you were.
That's quite all right.
Go ahead.
Well, let me just endorse what David Reif said, and that is that I've not met very many Iraqis and virtually none inside Iraq who wish the United States had not acted. There was a tremendous sense of relief on the part of Iraqis. There may indeed have been some grand theory behind why the Americans or this administration acted, but I believe it was the right thing to do. I believe it's a moral and just thing to do. This was a heinous regime that simply had to go. But this is not a case of Monday morning quarterbacking, as your caller suggested, because the game isn't over yet. And I don't mean to suggest this is a game, but it isn't over yet, and it's not too late. I wouldn't even say we've reached the intermission, whatever they call it. I hate sports.
Half-time.
Halftime, thank you. I'm more likely to use a theatrical metaphor than a sports metaphor. But anyway, we're not at halftime yet, and it is not too late. On the whole, I continue to support the administration's decision to go into Iraq. It should have done a better job. It can do a better job on a going forward basis.
David Reif, I want to ask you about one of the things we saw early on in Baghdad when soldiers only guarded the oil ministry. That seemed to send a pretty important lesson on the ground.
Well, a pretty important lesson. I mean, if you had wanted to devise a way in which you would alienate the very people who had wished so desperately for you to intervene, you would have done what the Americans did in the immediate aftermath of post-war Iraq. Warned by experience, in every conflict from Somalia through Haiti through Bosnia through Kosovo that there was always major looting after a war, and warned on this subject, as Faisal pointed out to me in one of the interviews I did for this piece, by the Future of Iraq Project about the problem of looting. The U.S. Army stood by. Why did they stand by? They stood by because they weren't prepared for it, because the civilian authority ordered them to train for the war itself. And as various documents I've publicized, I doubt I'm the first to see them, but I think I'm the first to reproduce them in print, which are after-action reports of various military units, state clearly you only win wars by practicing. There was no practice for the post-war. In the case of Baghdad, not only was the oil ministry was protected, that's bad enough. What's worse from an Iraqi standpoint is the oil ministry happens to be located among the other ministries, and U.S. soldiers stood by while those ministries burned. 17 out of 23 ministries burned while American forces looked on. How, if you're an Iraqi, you see this military force that does this extraordinary thing, it defeats a tyrant who you've suffered under, probably lost a relative to his secret police. You've dreamt of the day of your liberation. The Americans come and sweep this fellow away in less than a month. And then they claim they're unable to stop the looting? It doesn't make any sense. And indeed, it frankly doesn't make any sense to me. I also don't understand, this again is a point Faisal made to me, how you cannot protect the National Museum when the signs to that National Museum are in English in Baghdad. They could have followed the signs, again, this is Faisal's point, not mine, to that National Museum. You have to assume that people didn't care if you're an Iraqi. You can't just, in that situation, say, oh, well, the Americans say they're good, so I'll go along with it. It defies common sense.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines. We want to hear from Carl in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Carl. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How you doing? Listen, I've been listening to this one guy over there that says that this thing in Iraq was getting rid of Saddam was a good thing, et cetera, et cetera. You know, everybody agrees on that. That's pretty simple. It was the whole strategy behind it that doesn't make any sense. First of all, you know, you had Afghanistan. You had troops on the ground there. You could have launched a lot of counterinsurgent things in Iraq with Iraqis who wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and possibly followed up with a contingent into Iraq of regular soldiers.
Okay,
be that as it may, we were kind of lied to from the very beginning about this thing, and I just feel like, you know, we need an exit strategy pretty quickly. I think what we should be looking at is, you know, we're not going to democratize Iraq because the rest of the Arabs over there and all those other countries around it are not going to allow it. You know, being the big defender of Israel is nice for the Israelis, but it's not really good for the Americans in this case.
All right, so Carl, let's throw that one to David Phillips. I think you probably heard enough to be able to respond to that, David.
When the U.S. forces came in, the Iraqis were cautious. We had urged the Kurds and the Arab Shia to rise up against Saddam in 1991. We walked away, and they suffered terrible brutalities as a result of that. I think that indeed it's the case that Iraqis viewed the U.S. as a liberating force. But words matter. When we went to the U.N. Security Council and authored Resolution 1483, we had described ourselves as an occupying power. And the moment we did that, it completely redefined the relationship between the U.S. and its coalition partners and the Iraqi people. And instead of being liberators, we surrendered the high ground and we became just another colonizer and foreign occupation force to be resisted and rejected.
David Reif, speaking of words that matter, I wonder what it tells us that the Pentagon dealt with this in its pre-war planning through something called the Office of Special Plans, while the State Department was calling it the Future of Iraq Project.
Well, what it tells you here, I think, is that the Pentagon preferred that its operations take place in secret. Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, who is actually the guy who set up the Office for Special Plans, said in interviews and in testimony that they did it so it wouldn't be so clear publicly that they were actually setting up an alternative center for evaluating intelligence about Iraq. But listen, I think the larger question is that the Pentagon imagined, had really the arrogance to imagine, that it could simply start from scratch and recreate or create anew a plan for post-war Iraq, throwing out all the institutional wisdom, all the input from various distinguished people from the Iraqi opposition, throwing in, as David Phillips rightly says, all its eggs with Ahmed Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress, a decision, incidentally, that Richard Perle, for one, continues to defend on the record in interviews, and then on top of everything else, didn't assure basic security in Baghdad, which, as Faisal Istrabadi says, is the key. You can't say it. Secretary Rumsfeld is either ill-informed or being disingenuous, I have no idea which, when he says, well, you know, the problems are restricted to the Sunni triangle, and then as an afterthought, he sometimes throws in Baghdad. Baghdad is the key to the whole story. And I can tell you, as someone who spent a lot of time on the ground in Baghdad these last 6 months, not only is Baghdad not secure, but American officials act as if Baghdad is hostile territory outside a very small swath of central Baghdad, which they call the Green Zone, and in which they themselves operate with the utmost caution.
David Phillips, we're going to need to say goodbye to you in a moment. I wonder what concluding thoughts you might have for us before we do.
The Pentagon didn't make these decisions on their own. They found an Iraqi front man who could represent their interests. They were fed bad intelligence by Ahmed Chalabi. They made bogus decisions based on assurances that Chalabi and the INC was offering to them. When somebody does a post-mortem, and I think David Reif has taken a big step in that direction, what they'll find is that the level of collusion between Chalabi and civilians in the Pentagon was extraordinary. And the American people and the Iraqi people are paying the price.
Any chance that good work may be resurrected and put to some use?
Once you get on a slippery slope and you allow the conditions of insecurity that exist today to prevail, it's very hard to turn the train around. The planning that was done in the Future of Iraq project had a moment in time, and I think that that moment has passed.
Well, David Phillips, we thank you so much for spending a few moments with us this hour.
Thank you.
David is Deputy Director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're continuing our conversation with What's Gone Wrong in Post-War Iraq. After just a moment, you're welcome to join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection from NPR. And we're talking this hour about what's been happening in post-war Iraq and whether some of these events, at least, could have been predicted, were predicted, and not listened to. David Reif is author of a November 2nd New York Times Magazine article, Blueprint for a Mess, which connects a lot of those dots. And Faisal Istrabadi is senior fellow at the DePaul University School of Law in Chicago, who was part of a working group at the State Department, which spent months dealing with some of these issues. We want to go to one of our callers now from Columbia, South Carolina, and hear from Shell. Hi, Shell. Welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I'd just like to say a few things. I guess the first thing is I'm glad to hear Mr. Reif say that he thinks it's a correct thing that we've done by overthrowing Hussein. The second thing I'd like to say is that I don't feel for a minute, though, that I was ever persuaded that this thing was going to be a cakewalk. From the beginning of this thing, in April of last year, I knew it was going to be a struggle, or I felt like it was going to be a struggle, even after the military operations were over. Let's see, and the third thing I'd like to say is that from a historical perspective, looking at possibly like post-war Europe after the Second World War, I don't feel like what's happened so far has been a failure. We have relatively minimal casualties, and like one of the other guests was saying, you know, on D-Day in the Second World War, we were losing 100 people an hour or so. So that's all I'd like to say.
All right, Shell, we appreciate the call. Faisal, let me ask you to follow up on that, because you had made the point about keeping this in perspective. But also, I think about the months that you folks spent grappling with all of these issues, and, you know, it certainly didn't come as a surprise to you, I presume, what actually happened there. You had been talking about this.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the lack of security and the sequelae that followed from that. No, I mean, it was perfectly predictable. As David quotes me in the article, you know, you saw in Los Angeles that when the police, it wasn't that there was an absence of police in Los Angeles after the Rodney King verdict, is that they just didn't act in time, and mobs got out of hand, and you had the rioting. So it was perfectly predictable that in a power vacuum, you were going to have these kinds of problems. Second of all, I think many of us, and I did support and continue to support the American intervention in Iraq, many of us assumed we still had the Powell Doctrine in place, and so that you would have expected, you know, a 500,000 troops in the country, coupled with a majority of the Iraqi army of 400,000, so that you would have a substantial force there to do two things. One, to maintain security inside the cities, and two, to secure the borders. And unfortunately, those things just didn't happen. And we have 130,000 men and women on the ground. We disbanded the Iraqi army, and we're talking about maybe a year from now there'll be somewhere between 50,000 and 75,000 men in an Iraqi civil defense force in September of 2004. It didn't go the way I thought it would.
All right. Well, we're now turning to Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Douglas Feith. Thank you very much for joining us. I know you haven't been able to listen into the conversation earlier, Mr. Secretary, but to the point that was made earlier in the New York Times article about the State Department had been studying this for months, the Pentagon then had its own views and didn't really pay attention to what the State Department position was. Is this a legitimate clash of two world visions, only one of which could be correct, and the one that was chosen didn't seem to square with what subsequently happened?
No, I think that picture is not correct. There was a great deal of planning done for the war and for the post-war period throughout the U.S. government, and it involved all the relevant agencies of the U.S. government, the State Department, the Treasury, Defense, Agency for International Development, CIA, and others. And the civilian officials worked on plans for health and for education and sanitation, electricity, on and on. The military planners in the Central Command focused on unity of efforts, security, rule of law. I'm just reading off the headings of the kinds of plans they developed: civil administration, governance, humanitarian assistance, and the like.
Well, just generally, can you give us a sense of what you think has gone wrong and what has gone right?
Well, the planning anticipated, I mean, we sat down and tried to think through at various levels, at the strategic level, and then, of course, the military planners were working more at the operational and tactical levels. We tried to think through all the things that could go wrong and work on plans that would accomplish two possible goals. One is to prevent the problems from arising, and the second is to mitigate the problems if they did arise. And I think the planning actually scored some very important successes. We anticipated certain types of problems like a large number of internally displaced people or food crises or the destruction of oil fields. And we developed plans, including the way the war plan was constructed, to head off the possibility that those kinds of problems would arise, and we were successful. Now, there is part of what's going on here is there are some people in the course of doing this planning. There were numerous hundreds, thousands of memoranda written. And there are obviously some people out there who believe that their particular memorandum didn't get as much respect by General Franks or by the president,
sure,
as that memorandum writer might think. And
but
so you have people complaining that their particular piece of work didn't get as much respect as they think it was due.
Okay, but to the larger point, did you ever imagine that there would be more American soldiers killed after the combat was supposedly over than before, during the fighting?
Well, that's not the way. I don't think anybody here poses questions like that. We understood that we were going to be liberating a country from 35 years of really bad tyrannical rule. And we understood that there were going to be numerous problems that would arise in the aftermath. And those problems were in the security area, those problems were in the economic area, and then there were going to be the problems of developing political institutions. And we planned for that, and we have actually accomplished in each of those areas quite a bit. Now, there are ongoing problems. And I think anybody who had realistic expectations about what kind of a mess was going to be was created by the Ba'athist regime would understand that we were going to be inheriting a mess. This is a country whose infrastructure was ruined, whose people were tyrannized. And we understood that that was going to be a very big problem and a big challenge once the regime was overthrown.
And so how is the strategy changing now, given recent events?
Well, at a certain level, the strategy from the beginning has been to put responsibility into the hands of the Iraqis, recognizing that Iraq belongs to the Iraqi people. It doesn't belong to the United States. It doesn't belong to the coalition. We're not looking to run the place. We're not looking to colonize it or exploit it. We want the Iraqis to run their own affairs and have as much responsibility in their hands for their own lives as quickly as possible. That's been the strategy from the beginning. We are continually assessing our ability to transfer authority into their hands.
Well, and speaking of which, the point was made earlier by Faisal Istrabadi about reconstituting the Iraq army, that was a mistake to let them disband. Do you agree, and do you think that they should be brought back?
Well, the reality is that the army disbanded itself. What happened was there was a certain amount of fighting, and then the troops in particular, the divisions that were north of Baghdad, simply dissolved. They ran away. And there were no, when Baghdad was liberated, for all practical purposes, there were no military units intact. Now, what we did was we knew that the army had a whole bunch of problems. I mean, there were problems of corruption, and there were problems of abuse of the junior people by the senior officers. And what we did was we first of all wanted to make sure that you didn't have a whole bunch of impoverished former military people, so we paid them stipends.
Right, but do you need them now? Do you need them to actually be working and not just being paid?
Of course, and they have been recruited from the beginning for a variety of tasks, construction, security, and other tasks. And we've got a large number of them in the five security forces that we've been developing, the Army, the police, the Border Patrol, Civil Defense Corps, and the Facilities Protection Service. And a lot of the people who were Army people are now there. A lot of them are doing construction. A lot of them are doing other tasks in the economy.
But the Army as an Army? I mean, I guess I'm really trying to get to, are they coming back or not?
The Army as an Army is being trained. We have a program for training up an Army. And the Army is open to people who served in the previous Army, but they are being vetted, and we're not looking to bring into the new Army the people who were corrupt and tyrannical and were key instruments of Saddam Hussein's oppression. But a lot of the people who were in the Army were conscripts and people who were not ideological Ba'athist criminals. They were just ordinary people who were swept up in the conscription for the army, and those people are welcome to play a role in the new Iraqi army.
Mr. Secretary, I'm sure you're aware of the Washington Post poll that showed that more Americans now disapprove of the war, and I wonder what you make of that and how the administration can, what if anything the administration can do to keep public support there for having boots on the ground in Iraq.
Well, I think that the American people in general understand that we face serious problems that in the world, and the attack on 9/11 really drove home to a lot of people the kind of threats that we face in the world from from terrorist groups who are backed by state sponsors, and this is a security challenge the United States is going to face for a long time. And we are working on building up a government in Afghanistan and governing institutions in Iraq that are going to make the world a lot safer and are going to deny terrorists the opportunity to use those territories or the resources of those governments to do the work they do. And I think that the American people understand that we have an important stake in success in the war on terrorism, including in particular in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also elsewhere. And they understand we have to do what we have to do.
How long do you think American troops will have to remain there? Will there be any effort in the next year or so to bring more American troops home? Or, in fact, perhaps a buildup, as we heard this weekend also from Senators Biden and Lugar. They said, no, you need more troops in there, not fewer.
Well, I think that the way we look at this is we have to see how the security situation develops, and then we have to have the forces that we need to deal with it. When we look at the question of what kinds of forces we need to deal with the security problems, we take into account not just American forces, but coalition forces and Iraqi forces. And as Secretary Rumsfeld was saying on the various Sunday morning shows, we think that the total number of forces will probably go up, though the number of U.S. forces we don't anticipate will necessarily have to go up and may in fact be able to come down as we get more trained, capable Iraqi forces in place and possibly some additional coalition forces.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. We thank you very much.
Good to talk to you.
Secretary Faith. Douglas Faith is Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. We were joined earlier by David Reif, author of the November 2nd New York Times Magazine article, Blueprint for a Mess. Faisal Istrabadi is senior fellow at the DePaul University School of Law in Chicago. And earlier this hour, we spoke with David Phillips, deputy director of the Center for Preventive Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. You can continue the conversation on our website, theconnection.org. We had help today from Glenn Alexander and Mark Largy. The Connection is produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection.